Dinner with the Serranos was less formal than she'd feared. The hotel staff brought in a buffet and left it, and people served themselves from it, sitting wherever they fancied. Esme had a corner of a big, puffy sofa with a table at her elbow, and Dolcent beside her, offering explanations.
And I told him that technology wasn't mature enough, but he's determined.
Ionis, a distant uncle, in material research. You just missed him when you were on Kosciusko. He's a terrible bore. But what he knows, he really knows.
And if she ever takes that tone to me again, I'll rip the brass right off her.
And that's Bindi. Never mind her. She's not as bad as she sounds.
A shrimp came flying through the air with deadly accuracy to bounce off Dolcent's head.
Am I not, you miserable eavesdropper?
Calmly, Dolcent picked up the shrimp.
No, you're not. Nor am I an eavesdropper. When you're talking loud enough to be heard three rooms away...
Bindi shrugged and turned away.
Is it always like this?
Usually worse. But I'll be accused of dire things if I try to explain Serrano family politics. You come from a large family yourself, right? You should know.
There was, after all, some of the same flavor in the interactions. The loud ones, staking out their space and all their areas of power. The quiet ones in the corners, raising a sardonic eyebrow now and then. Bindi would be an Aunt Sani. Baron's mother, like her stepmother, seemed to be a quiet peacemaker. Harris Serrano pulled up a chair to the other side of the end table, sat down, and put her plate beside Esme's. Esme had never thought of Commander Serrano wearing anything but a uniform, but here she was in a silvery green patterned silk, a loose tunic over flowing slacks.
Esme, I don't know if you remember me.
Yes, sir. Commander.
Harris, please. This room's so full of rank otherwise, we can hardly talk to each other. I don't think I've seen you face to face to thank you for saving our skins at Xavier. And not just ours.
Dolcent pointed with a crab leg, a gesture that would have been a deadly insult on Altiplano.
Harris, not during dinner. I know you're going to talk tactics to her sometime, but not now. She's going to be married. You could at least choose a more suitable topic.
And you'd talk clothes to her, Senta? Or flowers, or which way to fold the napkins at the reception?
Dolcent didn't seem perturbed by Harris's intensity. Esme watched with interest.
Better than old battles during dinner.
Picked out your wedding outfit yet, Esme?
No, sir. Harris. Bryn says she's taking care of it.
Dear me, how did that happen?
She found out I had no ideas, and then the next thing I knew, she was sending me fabric samples and talking about designers.
She is something, isn't she? You should have seen her years back when she was really wild. If you're not careful, she'll organize the whole wedding.
Esme was feeling reasonably relaxed and almost full when she saw Admiral Vita Serrano coming toward her, with an expression far less friendly than those around her. Esme tried to get up, but the Admiral waved her back.
There's something you must know. I haven't told the others because it didn't seem fair to tell them behind your back. It's not widely known. In fact, it's been safely buried for centuries. But since those idiots in medical sent most of the flag officers off on indefinite inactive status, several of us decided to clean up the Serrano archives and transfer them onto more modern data storage media.
Yes, sir?
You know the official history of the regular space service, how it is an amalgam of the private space-going militias of the founding families?
Yes?
What you may not know is that despite the effort made to eradicate the memory of which fleet family once served which family, these realities still influence fleet policy, perhaps more than they should. The Serrano legacy, to the extent that we have one, consists in the peculiar fact of our origin.
A long pause, during which Esme tried to guess which of the great families had once had the Serranos as no doubt difficult bodyguards.
The family we served was destroyed. We were the space-going militia. At the time of the political cataclysm that wiped out our employers, we were far away guarding their ships. After that, we could not go back, for obvious reasons. And when the regular space service was organized some 30 years later, most of our family petitioned to be enrolled. We were considered by some safer because we were unaligned.
Esme could think of nothing to say.
This much is well known, at least to most of the senior members of Fleet, and it's been at the root of some resentment of the Serrano influence. Every generation or so, some smart aleck from another Fleet family tries to suggest that we were part of the rebellion against our family, and then we have to respond. If we're lucky, it's handled at the senior level. But a couple of hundred years back, we and the Barringtons lost two jigs in a duel.
Esme noticed that the room had grown quieter. The others had come nearer and were listening.
The family we served was based on a single planet. Many families were in those days. And that planet...
Esme felt a chill down her back.
That planet, Esme, was Altiplano. Your world.
Esme wanted to say, "Are you sure?" But she knew that Admiral Serrano would not have said it if it hadn't been verifiable.
That much the Serranos know. We all know. And there were some who argued against you on those grounds. I didn't. I felt that you'd make my grandson a fine partner. And I said so.
Esme looked at Baron, trying to read his face, but she couldn't.
There's more, and I think I may be the first person to see this for centuries. I was down in the family archives, bored enough to look at a row of children's books written by some very untalented ancestor when I found it.
The Admiral held up a dingy brown book.
I don't think it's a children's book. I think it's someone's private journal, or part of it. The conservators think it dates from the time of the events it describes, more closely after, and the pictures it had were pasted in flat pics. The conservators couldn't find anything in the vid archives corresponding, and with maximal image boosting, this is the best we could get.
She slipped a package of flat pics out of the book and opened it. The images were still blurry.
Altiplano.
She could not mistake that pair of mountain peaks. And the building, the old part of the Landsman's Guild Hall, as shown in the oldest picture she had seen in her history classes.
You recognize it?
Yes. The mountains are the dragon's teeth.
And below them, an ancient bunker. She didn't want to think about that now.
And the building looks like the Landsman's Guild Hall, the way it was before they added onto it in my great-grandfather's time.
I thought as much. Behind one of the flat picks, hidden by it, I found this.
Admiral Serrano held up a piece of paper that didn't look old enough.
This isn't the original, of course. That's back home, with the conservators humming over it. This is a copy. And, Esme Suiza, it makes clear that your ancestors earned the enmity of mine by rebelling against their patrons and slaughtering them all.
What?
Your ancestors led the rebellion. They massacred the family we were sworn to protect.
How can you know that, if no one survived?
Listen. Against these our oath is laid. The sons of Simone Escondon and the sons of Barrio Suiza and the sons of Mario Vicarios, for it is they who led the rebellions against our patron. Against their sons and their sons' sons to the most distant generation. May their land brides be barren and their priests burn in hell. For they murdered their lawful lord and all his family, man and wife, father and mother, brother and sister, to the youngest suckling child. There is blood between their children and our children. Until the stars die and the heavens fall. Signed, Miguel Serrano, Irencia Serrano, Dominguez Serrano.
Silence held the room. Esme could scarcely breathe. She glanced around. The faces that had been welcoming an hour before had closed against her, stone hard, the dark eyes cold. All but Baron, who looked stunned, but not yet rejecting.
I never heard this.
I don't suppose they would brag about it. What story did you hear?
In our history, there was a war, but also a plague. And a third of the population died of that, including the founders.
Is that what you call the family?
Yes. I suppose, though, I never knew there was one great family. I'd always thought of them as many families.
You never heard the name Garcia MacDonald?
No.
Ah. I've no doubt the rebels destroyed all evidence. There was nothing to show against them when Altiplano joined the Familius Regnant 300 years later. All we could do was watch. And we did not then know which of the people on Altiplano had been involved. By then, the regular space service had formed around us.
Was that the family? Garcia MacDonald?
Yes. A family Serranos had served beside as far back as the wet Navy days of old Earth. Tell me about this war, as you heard it.
Esme dredged up what she remembered of those childhood lessons.
The Lifehearts and the Old Believers, the founders wanted to bring in more colonists, free birthers and Tamidians, to work the mines and develop the land. The Old Believers objected to the number of Tamidians the founders wanted to import. They knew that they'd be outnumbered in two or three generations because of the free birth policies. And the Lifehearts wanted development to proceed with due regard for the underlying ecosystem. But the founders wanted a quick profit. They brought in shiploads of Tamidians, and the Tamidians brought diseases alien to the Altiplanans, diseases they were immune to, genetically.
It came back to her now. Infant mortality soared among the Altiplanans as the diseases spread into an unprotected population. They would be outnumbered in decades, not generations. The Tamidians had mocked their beliefs, throwing down shrines and trampling the icons into dust. The founders had moved people off the open land, herding them into cities, where they sickened faster. Her great-grandmother had told her about the death year, when no Altiplanan baby had survived a week past birth, and about the land bride who had called a curse on the unbelievers at the cost of her own soul.
I don't know what she actually did. My great-grandmother never told me, if she even knew. But a plague came out of the mountains and the plains and up from the sea. And in the first year, the Tamidians died as our children had died, spewing blood and rotting as they fell. It was said that they begged the founders to let them leave, but the founders brought in more, until the city stank of death, and the founders themselves sickened.
A bioweapon?
No, at least nothing I know of. And Altiplanans do not use bioweapons today. But when the Altiplanans wanted to leave the cities and go back to the land, the founders denied them. And then there was war, but not to massacre them all, only to get back to the land from which they had been driven.
That's not the report we have. That's not what this says.
It's all I know. Are you sure your report is reliable?
Why wouldn't it be? A servant, someone escapes.
How? To what?
Atmospheric shuttle to the orbital station. Unfortunately, he carried the disease with him, and it infected the station crew. Only three of them lived, but they passed it on.
Baron reached for Esme's hand.
I don't believe it. How can you believe a little scrap of paper stuck in a child's book?
Not a child.
Whatever kind of book. How can you believe that the real secret truth was lost so long and only comes to light just in time to keep me from marrying Esme? I don't care. I do not care that she's from Altiplano. I do not care that this scrap of paper says her family were murderers hundreds of years ago. Are all Serranos saints? I love her, and I admire her, and I'm going to marry her if I have to leave the family to do it.
Esme grabbed for his other hand.
Baron, no. Wait, we have to find out.
I already know what I need to know. I love you, and you are faithful and true and brave, and you love me. That is what matters, not what happened then.
There was an oath sworn.
Baron rounded on her, and this time Esme could see the family likeness as if stamped in living bronze.
And are all oaths worthy? That's not what you told me, Grandmother, when I swore to keep Missy's secrets. There are oaths and oaths, you said, and it's a wise soul that swears rightly, which is why we swear few.
Then we must find the truth of this matter, grandson. Whether the story as we know it, or as the Suissas know it, is the truth. For if we know at last the names of those who killed our patrons, I see no possibility of peace between us.
We have an oath to the Familias. as you keep telling the other fleet families when they remember who were their patrons. Would you have Serrano's unravel fleet and possibly the Familia's as well to seek vengeance for ancient wrongs?
Silence, an uneasy silence in which Harris could almost hear the unspoken arguments based on rank, active service, combat experience.
It doesn't matter. I'm sticking by Esme no matter what you say.
The question is, will she stick by you? Or will she turn traitor like her ancestors?
Nonsense. The question is, does she love him?
That set off another uproar, in which love is nothing but hormones clashed with love is more than just hormones, and a dozen other comments Esme had heard before. Someone across the suite picked up the comm. Heads turned. People moved away, looking in that direction. Finally, Esme could see. A Serrano she hadn't met yet stood, one hand up for silence, listening, his face more gray than brown with some shock. Finally, he put the comm unit down.
Mutiny. There's been a mutiny on Copper Mountain, and the mutineers have 10 ships already.
What?
All leaves canceled. All personnel returned to their ships at once.
His eyes sought Vita Serrano's.
They're calling the inactive flags back, sir. You're to take the fastest possible route to headquarters.
Who? Did you get anything on who started it?
Bonartag was the first ship, Harris. But they took the Copper Mountain orbital station with convicts from Stack 3, and the commander there was named Bakarian.
Bakarian? Lepescu's staff. One of his staff officers. It's that bunch again, our own little blood horde. And you know how Lepescu's crowd feels about Serrano's.
Baron pulled Esme to her feet and wrapped his arms around her.
It's always something. But I do love you. And I will marry you. And nothing, not grandmother or history or mutinies or anything, is going to stop me.
Esme hugged him back, oblivious for a long, long, delicious moment, vaguely aware of people moving in the room, of doors opening and closing.
You've made your point, both of you. Right now, you'd better get in uniform and get going.
Esme lifted her head from Baron's shoulder, and saw nothing but uniforms now. Serranos with carry sacks and roller bags, one after another emerging from the side rooms and heading for the door to the lift tubes.
I do love him. And I'm not a traitor. And I won't hurt him.
There's a lot more at stake than the happiness of you two. But for what it's worth, I hope it works out for you.
Baron turned into his own room, and Esme went back to hers, stripping quickly out of the borrowed clothes and putting on the creased uniform she'd been wearing. Not even time to have it pressed. She looked at Dolcent's clothes, considered leaving them on the bed, and then remembered having seen her in uniform leaving with two others. She stuffed them into her own luggage. Maybe she'd run into Dolcent on a ship out of here. Smoothed her wayward hair and went out to find Baron waiting for her. In the hall, the last eight of the Serrano family were clustered at the lift tubes, waiting.
I will never again complain about having to come to a boring family reunion. First, we find out that what had seemed to be an ordinary inspection of a potential spouse is almost the lynching of an old enemy. And then there's a mutiny. Is it you, my dear, or the conjunction of Harris and Vita? Those two are certainly lightning rods.
Lightning and rod, I would say today. Sparks were definitely flying.
She knows that.
A speculative look at Esme that made her face heat up. One of the tubes opened, and they crowded in, descending so fast that Esme felt her stomach hovering near the back of her throat. The hotel lobby swarmed with a crowded mass of men and women in RSS uniforms, some struggling at the counters trying to check out, and others crowding to the exits.
Don't worry about registration. I'll take care of it. We were last out. That's my job.
That's Cousin Andy. Administration. Let's go.
The crush continued on the slidewalks and trams to the fleet gate of the station. Every news vid display had the story, with serious-faced commentators talking, while scenes of Copper Mountain played in the background. Esme didn't stop to listen, but there was a clump of people near every display. More and more people in uniform got on at every stop. Not only Serranos had been here, and Esme wondered how they were all going to get where they were going. At the fleet gate, she found out. As the long line snaked through the security gate, they were divided into crew and transients. Crew members of docked ships went directly to their ships, and transients were divided by specialty and rank. Within a couple of hours, Esme and Baron both had new orders cut, sending them out on a civilian liner to join a battle group forming for Copper Mountain. They walked back down the concourse and found 18 other fleet personnel in the waiting lounge for the Cecily Marie. 13 more appeared before they boarded, and a knot of angry civilian passengers were by then complaining bitterly to the gate agent.
Welcome aboard. Please take your seats. You'll be shown your cabins later.
The steward looked tense, as well he might. With 33 last-minute military passengers, a mutiny in fleet, who knew what else? Esme and Baron sat down together in the observation lounge, and she wondered if he felt as peculiar as she did. Probably not. She had come off this very ship not 6 hours before, and now she was back on it.
Nothing lasts forever. Even this voyage has to end sometime.
I hope so.
Hobart Consuline glared at the face on the screen.
Mutiny? What do you mean, mutiny?
Copper Mountain, my lord. Mutineers have taken it over, the whole system.
Copper Mountain was a long way away. Hobart had no idea how far exactly, but far enough. A training base of some sort. Probably a bunch of disgruntled trainees and nothing to worry about.
Who's in charge?
My lord?
Who is in charge of Copper Mountain, the base there?
A blank look followed by a confused gabble about main base and camp this and island something.
Never mind, just put a cordon around it.
A cordon, my lord?
Cut them off! Blockade or cordon or whatever you people call it, just isolate them and they'll run out of supplies soon enough.
A different face appeared, this one somewhat older.
Speaker, you do not understand. The mutiny began at Copper Mountain, but the mutineers now control the entire system. They have the orbital station and the system defenses. We know at least 10 warships are involved. That's enough to mount an attack on any other orbital station or even one of the more lightly defended planets.
But why would they do that?
We don't know, Lord Consuline. And not knowing their plans, we must take what precautions we can to protect the most vulnerable population centers.
Damn them! I want to know who they represent. I want to know now!
My lord, the first thing is to secure...
I'll wager it's the Barraclough's. Or the Serranos.
We have no information to that effect.
Well, find out! I'll expect a report immediately.
Hobart swung his chair around so fast he banged his knee on his desk.
Blast them. Smug, condescending. All they want is to feather their own nests anyway.
He sensed, as he always did, the vast, sticky web of someone else's conspiracy, someone else's malice and opposition.
Why can't they see that I'm only trying to make things better for the Familius Regnant? Why do they always have to argue, talk back, bicker, complain? If they would only do what I tell them at once and without argument, the government could move smoothly, quickly, responding to whatever crises come up. But no! They let personal ambition, mere selfishness, and silly pride get in the way!
Tears stung his eyes, and he blinked them away. It was tempting to resign and let them find out what a disastrous quicksand pit they'd be in without him. He'd certainly done his part. He'd earned respite. But no, he would do his duty as he had always done it. He would uproot the lazy, conniving schemers who laughed at him behind his back and save the realm in spite of itself. He placed his own call. He would not work through that lemon-faced Poisson, and demanded of the man's secretary a word with his Minister of Defense.
A terrible thing.
Don't you start. I'm getting no help out of the Grand Admiral's office.
They're upset. You know, Lord Consuline, the Grand Admiral was a mere one star before the other flag officers were sent away.
Don't make excuses, Ed. Mutinies don't come out of nowhere. I want to know who's responsible for this outrage. Names, dates, the whole drill. Heads will roll, do you hear me, Ed?
Absolutely, Lord Consuline. As soon as I know anything, I'll report.
I have enemies, you know. There are those who would like to embarrass me. I could name names.
In the fleet, my lord?
Not exactly. Though I understand that the Serranos were quite close to Lord Thornbuckle and his daughter. Weren't they involved in her rescue? That flagrant misuse of government resources?
Yes, my lord. But no Serranos have so far been identified as crew members of any vessels involved. In fact, a large group of them were attending a social function.
A flagrant alibi! Suspicious by its very nature.
It was a betrothal party, I understand. My lord, Fleet asked my permission to cancel the order removing rejuvenated flag officers from active duty, and, of course, I gave it.
Why?
Because we need them, my lord. With part of the fleet in mutiny, we need loyal officers, and especially the command structure.
How do you know they didn't engineer this mutiny just to be put back in the cushy jobs they had before?
Lord Consuline, there is no evidence.
If you're going to argue, Ed...
My lord, I'm not arguing. I'm only telling you what the facts are as we know them.
And you don't know anything worth knowing!
Hobart cut the connection, started to whirl his chair, and stopped just short of banging his leg again.
I am surrounded by complete incompetence. I made that man. I taught him, shaped him, and brought him into the government, and this was my reward. Insubordination, incompetence. And none of them have lived up to my hopes for them. Instead of working with me, supporting me, helping me, they all act like spoiled prima donnas. Can I find anyone better?
Gunnar, wake up, man.
Gunnar rolled over and glared at his cousin.
Oh, it is my off-watch. The ship is now in pieces. Go away.
Gunnar, listen, we just sucked up a Priority One report.
Is Lysa crazy? If we go sucking fleet data,
there's a mutiny, Gunnar.
Mutiny?
10 ships they know of, all in the Copper Mountain system. Who knows how many elsewhere?
Gunnar was wide awake now, his stomach in a cold knot.
Open mutiny?
That's what it said. A ship sent down LACs to a prison downside, brought up a bunch of dangerous criminals, used them to break the orbital station, got control of the communications and system-wide defenses, and has declared the system be a part of the Society of Natural Men.
It sounded like nothing Gunnar had ever heard of. Natural men, as though they ran around naked and ate raw fish.
And who is that when it's at home?
My guess is it's some of those bloodthirsty lad who hung around with Admiral Lepescu.
Lepescu's dead.
Meanness isn't just because one mean man dies. I wonder if Kaim's all right, or if he's mixed up in this in some way.
He'd have told us. He's family.
Can you see real conspirators confiding in Kaim? He's so sure he can't be fooled, he's like the man showing pickpockets where he carries his wallet. I'd hate to have a Tarakian involved, even by accident.
I'm more concerned about the rest of the family. Mutiny and fleets going to play hob with shipping schedules, ours included. Things were unsettled enough before.
Which is why I woke you up. We're playing skip the loop with the Tarakian harvest, and Lysa says we're almost on tight beam range.
We don't have to tube over, do we?
Gunnar hated ship-to-ship transfer tubes worse than being woken out of a sound sleep.
No, or rather you don't. I do, but they want to talk to you.
Gunnar rolled out of the bunk and rubbed his head vigorously. He was not any good fresh out of sleep. He could have smacked Basil just for looking so brisk and awake. On the bridge of Flavor, Lysa grinned at him.
Exciting times, Gunnar.
I never prayed for excitement.
He just wanted to live his life in peace. He held the memory of dinner around the table on Cascadar. The mellow lamplight, the smell of the food, the children's sweet piping voices. He shook his head and linked into Harvest's comm officer.
Your analysis, Gunnar.
Gunnar was barely awake, yet though he could barely speak, he could feel the little rolls moving in his brain, the numbers flickering past faster and faster.
What's your cargo?
Class D tungsten shell casings in the number 4 hold. Comfortable explosives in number 3. The rest unremarkable.
All of it.
They never wanted to tell all of it, but it was the little things which might turn a profit projection on its head.
High-fashion software to 8 destinations, plumbing supplies, plastic joints mostly, but also some flapper valves and the gross of solar-powered pumps, a cube of stuffed dates, and 2 bales of synth silk, undyed.
Gunnar knew from experience that the dates and the synth silk wouldn't be on the manifest. Crew's personal possessions, not for sale. Except at a profit.
Fine. And your destinations and route?
That came in a long string directly into his desk comp. He looked at it and let the little gears and rollers in his head have their way. Then, just as Basil, suited up, waved at him from the bridge entrance, he had it.
Xavier.
What? That's not on our list at all.
I know, but I'll bet they need our Class D and they listed as a priority destination in the fleet directive of last week. Nobody wants to go out there.
Neither do I.
Yes, you do. It's a long way in the wrong direction from Copper Mountain. Nothing to attract mutineers, no ships to grab, no weapons factories to raid, no rich commerce to prey on. There's a fleet presence, but after what happened, it'll be the most loyal crews they have. It's an ag world. Livestock breeders, minimal hard goods manufacturing. Also, Xavier is still rebuilding. They'll take the plumbing supplies, too. They use a lot of synth silk, and they have their own dyers. After that, go to Rotterdam. They're also agricultural, and they have a little cross-trade with Xavier.
What about the high-fashion software? It's only saleable in a skinny window.
Tube it to us, and I'll send it on by the next one we meet, when things are more settled.
If they ever are. Fine, then. Godspeed.
At Qinglin Station, Baron and Esme got their orders and took the opportunity to stop by a dessert stand in the concourse that led from the civilian docking lounges to the fleet gate, where they were to join the RSS Rosa Gloria. They had less than 2 hours of time alone, with alone defined generously, but it was a great improvement on a suite full of serranos. Esme swung her feet against the counter. She felt like a child, sitting on this tall stool and spooning up ice cream.
It's like Rondon and Jillian. Old family quarrels and all.
You mean Romeo and Juliet. Shakespeare, very old.
No, I don't. I mean Rondon and Jillian. Who are Romeo and Juliet?
You must have heard of it. Maybe the names changed in your version. Montagues and Capulets, traditional enemies, duels and banishment, and finally they died.
No, they didn't.
Yes, they did. She took a potion and made her look dead. And he thought she was dead, and killed himself, and then she found him and killed herself. Tragic, but stupid. He could have asked a doctor, though my teacher said they didn't have doctors back when the story was first told.
Not Rondon. I met him.
You're talking about real people?
Of course. Rondon Escandera and Jillian Portobello. Their families had quarreled years before and forbade them to marry.
Why?
The quarrel? I don't know. I never heard being a girl. I think my father knew, though. It was all very exciting. Rondon rode across our land to get to Jillian, because her father had sent her to my great-grandmother to wash Rondon out of her head, he said. And that's where I met her. I was a child and she was a young woman. Then one night Rondon came and she went out the window.
So what happened?
Her father came and yelled at my father and wanted to yell at my great-grandmother. My grandfather and uncle yelled at him. There was a lot of yelling. I hid out in my room most of the time, so no one would ask me any awkward questions.
Ask you, what did you know?
I was the one who'd carried the messages back and forth. Jillian was nice to me. I'd have done more for her than carry a note a few miles. And I knew where they'd gone. My great-grandmother tried to talk Jillian out of it. Said it would be a disgrace for them both. But finally gave them permission to live far in the south, on our land.
Are they happy?
I don't know. After the yelling died down, I heard no more about them. But my point was that we're like that. Our family's opposed to our marriage, and we also must choose to lose our families, or each other.
I don't want to lose you.
I don't want to lose you.
It's not fair to blame you for what some ancestor of yours did.
If they did. For all they know, I'm actually the last living heir of that family, whatever its name was. Maybe they should be cheering me on instead of hating me.
They don't hate you. They're just confused. It's all Personnel's fault anyway.
Personnel's fault?
Well, if they hadn't put the rejuved admirals out of work, Grandmother wouldn't have been bored in the family's archives. Imagine what it must have taken to get her to look at a row of children's books.
After she'd sat on the porch. Is there a porch?
Oh, yes. She sat on the porch and looked at the lake, I'll bet. Then she took a walk. Then she read the news flashes, and then she thought she should do something useful and improving.
Like read children's books.
Baron gave Esme a long look.
I don't want to read children's books.
No.
She stared into the ice cream, trying not to blush again. She knew exactly what he wanted, and what she wanted.
Esme, the whole universe doesn't want us to get married. They're so sure they know why we shouldn't. What we should do to be happy 10 or 20 or 50 years from now. But I want to marry you. Do you still want to marry me?
Yes.
Then let's do it. In spite of them, and in spite of the mutiny, in spite of good common sense, let's do it.
Oh, yes. But how?
If nothing else, we'll hold hands over a candle. But we have an hour, maybe more, before the ship gets here. If we don't waste it,
let's go.
When they looked on the board, the Rosa Gloria was 72 minutes from undocking. 72 minutes. Finding a magistrate with the authority to perform the ceremony took 33 of them. Persuading him to do it, both of them talking, proving their identification, showing all the paperwork, took another 26. 13 minutes left. They stood hand in hand, and the magistrate rattled through the legal requirements as fast as possible, then added something Esme presumed was a blessing in his religion, though not in hers. Signing and stamping and sealing the various documents took another 8 minutes, and they were both racing back to the fleet side of the station as fast as they could.
We're crazy.
I love you. Oh, rats, it's gone yellow.
Come on!
Hand in hand, they ran for it, stride and stride, as faces turned toward them. People stared. Someone yelled. She didn't care. They hit the far end of the access tube just as the light turned red, and a very disgusted petty major held his fist on the controls to let them in.
Welcome aboard, sir. Sirs.
Behind him was a major. Esme got her hand untangled from Baron's, and they both saluted.
Jake Serrano and Lieutenant Sweeza, I presume?
Esme hadn't had time to think about whether she wanted to change her name.
Yes, sir.
You cut it pretty close, didn't you? We almost had you down as possible mutineers.
Us?
You. We're treating no-shows that way. What did you expect?
Sir, we need to report a change of status.
We?
We.
I assume you mean a change of status that could affect billeting. All right. For now, we're assigning transient officers half-shift duties. You'll be on second shift, second half for now. Let's see. Lieutenant Sweeza, we'll be meeting Navarino when the battle group is formed, and you'll be rejoining her. She's in jump transit right now. Jig Serrano, you're about to leave your Falcon, but the ship you were assigned to has gone over to the mutineers. So your assignment's still up in the air.
Goshawk went over?
So I hear.
But it wasn't anywhere near Copper Mountain.
Serrano, I don't know any more than I've said. For now, you can wait for your chance at admin and the captain in the junior officer's mess.
Yes, sir.
Captain Atherton stared at them for a long moment.
You what?
As senior, Esme had made the announcement.
Got married, sir.
But you didn't tell anyone.
No, sir.
Your paperwork's not even complete.
No, sir.
You know this could be voided by personnel.
Yes, sir.
Personnel could void what it wanted, but in her heart she was married, and nothing could change that.
Why did... never mind why. Because you're both idiots with dung for brains pulling a stunt at a time like this.
That's why, sir. Things keep happening, and we wanted...
This is not a romance story cube, Lieutenant. This is a warship in time of war. I don't care if you two were in love or if someone spiked your cocktail. We don't have time for this. You shouldn't even be on the same ship.
Esme stole a glance at Baron, who stole a glance back. They hadn't been on the same ship when they weren't married, since the Kosciusko.
Why couldn't you just have had mad, passionate sex and gotten over it? Why did you have to get married? Serrano, do you have any idea what your grandmother's going to do to me when she finds out?
It's not your fault, sir.
Baron looked a little grim, and Esme knew what he was thinking. It wasn't the captain of this ship who would bear the brunt of Admiral Serrano's anger.
No, it's not, but she'll blame me for not stopping it. You're not laughing, are you?
No, sir.
Good. Because while this entire situation is so bad that laughter is the only sane response, I don't like to be laughed at. And I'm not laughing, so you can't laugh with me. This happens in every crisis we have. I don't know what it is about youngsters. And you, Lieutenant Sweeza, are really too old for that category. But every time there's a military crisis, a bunch of you decide to leap into the sack, and a few of those leap into marriage. It must be some atavistic quirk from the childhood of humankind.
It's not like that. We didn't rush into it. We'd waited and waited and filled out paperwork and argued with our families.
And then Grandmother came up with something really awful.
Esme shot him a warning look.
And then the news of the mutiny came in and everyone was rushing around.
Uh-huh. And you got married because your personal happiness was more important than anything else.
As important as... Sir, I don't see how being miserable makes us more efficient. Right then, we were miserable not being married and being apart.
So you'll function better if you're together?
I think so.
Good. Prove it. I see you're on second shift. Second.
We're certainly crowded enough to make sharing a cabin during your sleep rotation reasonable. But the first time one of you is groggy on duty, I swear I'll space you both. Clear?
Yes, sir.
And you will both inform your families immediately, while we're still within range of the system Ansible. We'll be in jump transit before a reply comes, no doubt, but at least you'll have told them. You have 1 hour.
Yes, sir.
The exec had overheard enough and came in.
You're letting them bunk together?
It saves time. They'd get together somehow if we put them on alternating shifts with shifting bunk assignments. This way they don't waste any time or energy hunting each other down. My guess is, from their records, that they'll be just as efficient as anyone else.
The Serrano family won't be happy.
Well, as they said, it's not my fault. I didn't arrange it or sanction it. It was done when I got them. Besides, I'm not a Serrano. Back when I was an ensign on Claremont, and she was commanding, Vita Serrano chewed me out for spending too much time with my girlfriend. Said I'd outgrow the silly chit. Well, I've been married 28 years now to that silly chit. And the day I outgrow Sal, I'll be dead. It's only justice that her grandson falls in love with someone she thinks is unsuitable. Though how she could object to Lieutenant Suiza is beyond me. Maybe these two will be understanding of one of my kids someday.
The compartment was predictably cramped, with a second narrow bunk rigged above the first, and they would share it with four other officers. It was their space only during their assigned sleep shift. But they were alone, with a locked door between them and the rest of the universe. For now, that made all the difference.
Sorry about the hurry.
Hmm?
The beautiful dress Brun was having designed for you, and the ring I'd ordered, and a ceremony you would recognize.
We can do that later if we have the chance. I'd rather have this.
This engaged both of them more than adequately for some time.
Still.
Don't distract me.
Okay.
Hostite Fieri had always known this day would come. The chairman sat behind his desk, and on the desk lay the knife, the ancient, black-bladed knife, the hilt to the chairman's left.
Hostite, you have been a good and faithful servant.
Sir.
You have been long in our service.
Sir.
You are the blade, I trust. We have an enemy time will not wound for us.
Sir.
You are my blade, Hostite.
To the heart, Chairman.
To the heart, Hostite. Without prejudice.
A kill. A kill beyond the borders, but only one. For that, he was glad. That only one kill would burden his soul in eternity.
Come near, and I will aim my blade.
He was already dead, though he walked. Coming near could not increase his mortality. Hostite waited, and the chairman said nothing for long moments.
It is a grave thing to order the death of one who has never been under your authority. I give this order reluctantly, Hostite. Not only for what it means to you and to me, but for what it means to the peoples, the clients. But there is no other way. The man is swollen with ambition and would force on us all his ungodly ways.
They are heathen, sir.
Not all like this, Hostite. I bid you kill Hobart Consuline. None other of his family. Only him.
Hostite bowed.
The method, sir?
Your choice.
His last assignment. His death at the end. And the death of the chairman, who would no longer have his personal swordmaster, the shadow of the Master of Swords, to ward him from that danger. He felt the honor, and it warmed him. Death had not been a stranger to him for years, and nothing waited for him in age but someone's blade when he faltered. This he could do for his people and his faith, and he almost smiled thinking of it.
Go now.
Hostite withdrew, already thinking how he would do it. Hobart slung his clothes into the hamper.
Worse every day, those damned idiots.
He put on his fencing tights and began his exercises. When the door opened, he glanced up, expecting Iag and Perseus. But he had never seen this swordmaster. An older man, a bit stockier, in sleek black stretch, with a funny-looking red cap and red slippers. In his hands, he carried a sword unlike those Hobart used.
It is time.
Hobart straightened up and pushed past him into the saal.
All right. Where's that other swordmaster? I'm used to him.
He was indisposed, Lord Consoline, and asked me to take his place, that you might not be inconvenienced awaiting his recovery.
Hobart stared at the man.
You're certainly more formal than he was. What's that blade you've got? Do I have to work out with that? I suppose you want me to learn yet another stupid archaic weapon.
Not if you don't wish it. What weapon would you prefer?
Rapier.
Hobart looked around and realized that his coach wasn't there either. He would have to get his own gear, since he didn't think this old man would oblige him. But to his surprise, the swordmaster moved quickly to the racks and brought him a rapier. His favorite, he realized, and a mask.
You seem angry.
Hobart didn't want to talk about it. He came to exercise to forget, or at least ignore, his problems for a time.
I am.
Did someone ill-treat you?
Yes, but I'm here to fence.
Of course. My pardon, Lord Consoline. Swordmaster Yagen told me of your dedication, your seriousness.
He did?
Hobart had never been sure the swordmaster approved of him, though the man had always been courteous and respectful.
Yes. He said you were unusual, a man who took everything seriously.
Hobart adjusted the mask and bounced a little, loosening his knees. He had skimped on stretching, and if Yagen thought him serious, then he had better be serious.
That's true enough. Not many are... you would not believe... No, never mind.
But if you need to stretch out and ease your mind with talk, as your sinews with exercise, then you should, my lord.
Oh, very well.
Hobart laid his blade down on the mat, carefully, and leaned over to grasp his ankle.
I hope it doesn't bore you. And you must realize it's confidential.
Of course. You need to turn your wrist a little more, my lord.
It's these idiots, these dung-for-brains weaklings that I sponsored to high office. I made them what they are. I led them and taught them and groomed them for office, and now that they're in power, they simply will not do what they're told.
Ah, and now, my lord, another centimeter of pull. Yes. And now the other leg? Remembering to keep the wrist rotated in. Yes.
They are supposed to be my supporters, but do they support? No. They go off and do stupid things, like that idiot Origiemos.
And to the other side now, my lord?
Oh, it's enough to make a saint spew rocks!
Hobart found it amazing how easy the fellow was to talk to. The combination of the warm, quiet room and familiar scents of leather, steel, oil, sandalwood, cedar, and the quiet, patient, steady hands of the older man, molding him into one shape after another that stretched out knots he hadn't even realized he had.
It is difficult when subordinates are not obedient.
Exactly. I've tried reasoning, scolding, even threats.
And they resist.
They certainly do. If they only realized I'm trying to make things better.
Hostite had studied the files. He knew Hobart Consoline as well as anyone could, who had only files to go on. But the man in reality had shocked him. He was so miserable, so full of anger and fear and envy, that the whole room stank of it. His body had been stiffened and deformed by it. The very muscles of his face were saturated with his rage and fear. He was a skin bag of poison. He was immortal, being a rejuvenant, as the silver and cobalt rings in his ear boasted to the world. So old, and yet so full of folly. He had learned nothing, Hostite saw, in all those decades of renewed vigor that rejuvenation had given him.
Pride. My own pitfall. Yes, this man is proud and bitter and angry. But why?
Hostite had never yet killed without understanding why those he killed were as they were. He must offer the opportunity for understanding, for contrition, for repentance, though he could not offer, must not offer, any chance of escape. He must give the soul a chance, while giving the body none. All that Lord Consoline was saying could be considered a confession, but in a true confession, the sinner knew that what he confessed was sinful. Hobart didn't seem to grasp that at all. Hostite listened to all of it. Hobart's envy of everyone whose personality drew others. Envy of everyone, in fact, for he could always find something in which another had received unearned benefit. Pride, a towering pride, certainly of his own rightness, and the moral weakness of others. Anger at everyone, avarice, for nothing was ever enough, even for a day. Lust, and a wide streak of cruelty that enjoyed humiliating others. And all of it, every sordid detail, drenched in self-congratulation. A swordmaster must know when enough was enough, and Hostite had that moment of revelation. This man would not ever realize his errors, not even in the moment of death. Poor soul, so benighted, so hopeless of a better eternity, so ignorant. But God gave each soul enough in time, if it chose to use it. And Lord Consoline's soul had had the same chance, years in fact, to come to a better understanding. Finally, he stood back.
Come now, Lord Consoline. You are feeling better. It is time for your lesson.
Yes, I am feeling better.
Hobart clambered up, rapier in hand, in body a little straighter than he had been, his mind a little clearer in the aftermath of confessing, even so inadequately, his current crop of sins.
It is not your associates. It is you.
Hostite was sure Consoline would not understand, but he had to try. Lord Consoline's eyes widened as he saw the movement of the great dark blade, the backswing which promised such power.
What?
Your failure.
The blade swung forward. Lord Consoline tried to parry with the rapier, and the blade sliced it short, sweeping on. Consoline jumped back, mouth open to yell, and Hostite pursued, choosing to dance the figure rather than step it. His pursuit and Consoline's fear used up the man's breath.
No! What are you doing? Help! Stop! Security!
Lord Consoline glanced from side to side, clearly frightened, and grabbed at another weapon off the rack.
I am your death. Your life is over.
Another swipe that parted a practice foil as if it had been a blade of dry grass.
Ask forgiveness from your god.
The man had none. But again, he must offer the chance.
I didn't do anything. It wasn't me. Don't!
The great blade took Lord Consoline's head off with one stroke, and the harsh stench of death overtook the sweet, spicy scent of cedar and sandalwood. The chairman of the board of the Benignity of the Compassionate Hand faced away from his desk, looking out the tall windows at the formal garden. A boisterous spring breeze whipped the tops of the cypresses, and even swirled stray petals from the early roses along the pebbled walks. From here, he could not see the fountains, but he could imagine the spray blowing out behind, a long, damp veil that would slick the marble rim of the cascade, the seats behind it, where the old ladies sat in their black dresses on fine days, watching the sea and the children playing. He lifted his gaze to the horizon, to the blue sea, its glittering tessellations flinging the sun back in his eyes. He had had, on the whole, a successful life, and since he had just made his final confession, he was conscious of it as a whole. This and this he had done well, and that he had done less well. On occasion, the grace of the Almighty had protected him from the consequences of his own errors, and on other occasions he had taken the blame for what was not his fault. All this was to be expected, and he regretted none of it, for regrets were useless. It had been a life of human shape and human content, and he was glad of it. If regret had been part of his mental furniture, he might have regretted, he almost regretted, this last necessity. It was not his fault that the Familius Regnant had fallen into the hands of Hobart Consoline, and that he had been forced, he had seen no alternative, to order the man's execution. It would have taken supernatural ability to foresee all that had happened to bring Consuline to power and to shape him into someone who could be so dangerous and offer so little maneuvering room to the Benignity. And no one expected supernatural ability of a chairman. Only that if he failed, he must pay the price. Those in the Benignity were in his power absolutely, but outside the Benignity, the rules changed. To compete, to convert, even to invade, that was allowable. To corrupt, and to have secret agents providing information and forwarding the interests of the Benignity, that was inevitable. But to call for the assassination of a foreign king, or whatever the foreigners called their heads of state, that was proof that a chairman had failed, had not seen trouble coming, had not managed affairs in another way, had not done, by means of stealth or influence or intimidation, what needed to be done. Still, no tool, no method was forbidden. God, in his wisdom, knew that emergencies happened. If, to protect the Benignity, a foreign king must die, then the chairman could so order, and so it would occur. So also would occur the death of that chairman, who had shown himself to lack the qualities of a chairman. Whether he was stupid, or old and tired, or misled by advisors did not matter. He had failed his people, and he must pay the price. Not unexpectedly, not cruelly, but surely and certainly, and with all due ceremony. No guards were in the room today. He had made his last confession, and his heart was as light and sunny as the spring breeze. When he heard the door, he turned. Some had chosen not to look, but he had never been afraid of the man who would kill him, only of the man who would let him fail his people. The Master of Swords stood by his desk, formally dressed, and carrying the dark blade they did not use for fencing. The chairman did not meet his eyes. It was impolite to look into the eyes. It could be interpreted as pleading.
You know my reasons.
Yes,
I have made my confession.
The Master of Swords stepped to one side and raised his blade.
Yes.
The Master of Swords swung, and the blade that had taken the life of 16 chairmen sliced through skin and sinew and bone as easily as a hot knife through butter. Blood spurted, but blood was nothing new in this place, and the servants knew how to clean it up. The master wiped the blade with a square of scarlet silk and laid that silk over the chairman's head.
In nomine patrum, requiescat in pacem.
Then, as he was, naked blade in hand, with flecks of Pietro Alberto Rossa Votari's blood on his cloak, he strode out of the office, through the anteroom, where the secretary was now already calling for servants, and would soon be notifying the family, down the hall and into the boardroom, where the board had been waiting for the chairman to appear and open the meeting.
The chairman has made his last confession.
Faces paled, but no one spoke.
The board will elect a new chairman.
Anxious looks back and forth, and at him. Some of these men had never been through the election of a chairman. Rosa Votari had held that office for 18 years. The swordmaster stood by the door with nothing more to say as they looked at him and away and back and away. It was nothing to him what they did, and nothing they said would he ever repeat. But they would not leave this room alive until one of them had been elected chairman by acclamation. The ship had been in downtransit only a couple of hours when the captain called Baron and Esme into his office.
I have messages from your families. They say they have more important things to worry about than you two. They're not happy with you, and they don't approve. But in the present emergency, they're not doing anything except talking about it. To each other.
To each other?
Yes. Admiral Serrano and General Suiza both signed this.
He handed over the hard copy.
Actually, all the Admiral Serrano and General Suiza. I don't know what you thought you'd accomplish by running off together, but you seem to have unified a substantial number of high-ranking officers in at least one thing. You're in trouble.
But we're married.
It's worth it.
It better be. Because when everything settles down, and there are no wars, mutinies, invasions, terrorist attacks, pirates, or other distractions, your families are going to come down on you like one planet hitting another.
This was, as May thought, a fairly accurate description of the probable interaction of Serranos and Suizas anyway, with the exception of themselves.
Now get out of here and go back to being the frustratingly competent officers you both are.
They did not scamper away in glee, because officers did not scamper.
When everything settles down, eh? That'll be the day.
If they wait that long.
Esme thought of her father and uncle, talking to Baron's grandmother and great-uncle. If they didn't kill each other right off, and the combined message suggested they hadn't, that was a dangerous combination to have running around the universe.
They'll get used to it. We aren't half as bad as we could have been. Suppose I'd married Cassie.
Esme gave him a look. They hurried down the passage to their tiny, but adequate for the immediate purpose, cabin.
The Serrano Legacy, Change of Command, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1998, Elizabeth Moon. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Mort Shelby, Andy Clements, Elizabeth Demery, Colleen Delaney, Tim Getman, Peter Stray, Dylan Lynch, David Coyne, Eric Messner, Casey Platt, Tom Simpson, Stephen Carpenter, Sherry Simpson, Elizabeth Jernigan, Christopher Graybill, Jonathan Watkins, Lily Beacon, Joe Brack, Tim Carlin, Sonny Lasky, Richard Rowan, Michael Glenn, Kate Foster, James Lewis, Tess Rowan, Ren Casey, Terrence Aselford, Scott McCormick, Ken Jackson, and Michael John Casey. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Wayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. Book adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. If you enjoyed Change of Command, be sure to look for Rogue Angel, available at road stops everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
My general now, and my assassin. Let all men, let all creatures of Corona tremble before you.
Something terrible is awake, my girl. The Dactyl walks Corona.
Quintal! You caught demons! You are a damned thing! I am with the victor.
I invite you to my home, creature of shadow. You cannot defeat me here. Not now.
I have failed. The demon knows. The demon knows of Elbryon, of Avalon, and the plan.
Be quick and be sure, Symphony!
Go on. You cannot move the damn mountain. Don't you make me death a meaningless thing, my friends. I beg you, get out.
Nightbird! Pony!
They cannot hear you, fool! They are already dead!
No! No, you lie!
Do I?
Wretched beast, I deny you! Son of a dial!
Don't
dismiss the epic confrontation between good and evil in R.A. Salvatore's Demon Wars, Book 1, The Demon Awakens, Part 3. Available now from Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.